From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We have achieved historic turnout in 2008 and 2012, especially in the African American community. I will consider it a personal insult, an insult to my legacy, if this community lets down its guard and fails to activate itself in this election. You want to give me a good send-off? Go vote!
That was President Barack Obama addressing the annual gala of the Congressional Black Caucus last September, for the last time as president, with a call for a high turnout among black voters in the hopes that it would lift Hillary Clinton into the presidency. Despite the president's call to help secure his legacy, the response was a falloff of votes in key black communities in cities like Philadelphia, which, observers say, helped Clinton's Republican rival secure the presidency. President Obama's legacy is the subject of political commentator Danny Haifong's column this week at blackagendareport.com. The article is titled, Obama's Departure is Reason to Feel Optimism Over Trump's Arrival. It begins with a statement, fears of Trump should not obscure the fact that Barack Obama's reign was a disaster. We spoke with Danny Haifong via Skype from Boston this past Sunday. Danny, welcome back.
It's good to be back, Don.
So, let's see. Let's talk about Obama's departure being one reason to be optimistic about Trump. Not a popular opinion. I'll start with this Slate article you sent me where Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren for even suggesting that people start trying to find common cause with the policies that Trump enunciated during the campaign that working people want and need, that somehow a betrayal and intrinsically racist.
Yeah. And this is going to be the subject, you know, my next Black Agenda Report article would talk about Obama's departure as being a reason for optimism, barring the arrival of Trump and not necessarily connecting them, but there is a deep connection to it, actually. But I think that what's important about this phenomenon is that Democrats right now are in a deep state of mourning over Obama's departure. There are a lot of articles going around that I think are related to this attack on Sanders and Warren for their mere statements and their mere speeches that have alluded to the need to hold Donald Trump accountable to a lot of the domestic policies that he gave lip service to over his campaign. Which I think were a product of a movement that, you know, you and Tony Montero and a few others have spoken about, where in these elections, millions of people have been set into motion in protest of the two-party corporate duopoly, seeing them as both the cause of the misery that the working class and ordinary people in a broad section, actually, of the U.S. population as a whole have suffered over the course of the last two or three decades. So, you know, there's a lot of pieces that are being shared by what calls themselves the left in the United States, basically talking about how by merely bringing up some of these domestic policy points that Trump, you know, this is not to mention his foreign policy, but just talking about some of the things he said, like instituting a 21st century Glass-Steagall, reducing the burden of student debt on, you know, the millions of students that are currently drowning in it, as well as renegotiating NAFTA to the benefit of working people. These are things that are seen as anathema and as directly connected to Trump's quote unquote white nationalism, which I don't know if a lot of these leftists have merely woken up, but, you know, white racism and white supremacy has been a staple of the U.S. society and the U.S. capitalist order for centuries. And it just doesn't make sense to me to not see the movement and the forces in motion right now that have compelled Trump to stake out this opposition to the two-party corporate duopoly on these very fine points. It just doesn't make sense to me to ignore that when paint it as some sort of a larger program of a racist agenda. It just doesn't make any sense, because what we're doing in effect is not actually attempting to address the contradictions of the Trump moment. I mean, let's think about this. Trump definitely harbors white racists and white nationalist sentiments that should be obvious to anyone who pays attention to the corporate media. But he also says these things about domestic and foreign policy that, you know, really should be a part of the left's broader program for social transformation in the United States and the world. And to think that he's saying these things out of racist contempt and not out of what is just the objective situation on the ground, millions of people suffering, millions of people miserable, and the need for him to just get votes, given the fact right. that the ruling class was against him, we're really missing the point. We're missing the point that there are a lot of people who either didn't vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, or who voted for Donald Trump or who voted third party. Oh. There's millions of people who did all of those things because they are actually a lot more advanced at the moment than what the left wants to acknowledge. And that's the big problem. And I think it's a product of what I talk about in my article. It's a product of this distortion of anti-racist politics in the United States that went on during the Obama era. There was a huge marketing apparatus behind Obama that basically was able to deeply suppress any movement for the material demands and material needs of the working class in favor of a rhetorical struggle against racism, whether that was through the Republican Party, so-called obstructionism, all of that, which painted Obama as a victim, which painted him as this cool, calm, collected, consummate politician that, you know, he couldn't do no wrong, and he was, you know, he was basically the greatest weapon of the ruling class that cemented this hangover, this inability to see, given how drunk a lot of the left was over the last 8 years, the forces that are in motion in front of us.
Yeah, you know, you have the condition of political discourse, the context for political discourse, the substance of political discourse in the United States in the media, as presented by the media, which is the main source of information for most people in this country, one where symbolism and not even symbolism, almost just like bites of information that symbolize certain things are used to substitute for essence. In other words, Trump could say whatever he wanted to say, as an example, but David Duke endorsed him, so therefore Trump is, you know, white supremacist, racist, crazy. You know, forget who Trump is, first of all, and then secondly, we'll get to the point where no matter who or what he is, what he had to do to get elected reflects more on the condition of people in the country and their perception of, or the relationships to the institutions that, they look to for relief from their growingly intolerable condition. Entire areas of policy that were raised during the election, like World War III with Russia, for example, and or China, are completely left out of the discourse, and the fact that he hires a strategist that is perceived as being a white supremacist, this Bannon, Steve Bannon, or Jeff Sessions, that's the essence of the phenomenon here. And no one is thinking in terms of, okay, here we go. This guy got elected despite the wall-to-wall opposition of the elite. Mm-hmm. And it was characterized in a way, even as presented by him to a degree, to a good degree, as something that intrinsically divides workers along the lines of race and immigration status and religion. And that has been excited more by, Hillary Clinton's campaign was all about that. There wasn't a counter policy, for example, in terms of dealing with Russia, other than, the Red Scare stuff. You know, Russia's hacking our election. Russia is a bad guy. We got to get tough with Putin. Yeah. And of course, the actual policy that, is partly her brainchild of deploying World War III to the borders of Russia and China. Mm-hmm. So you have articles like this one in Slate that I referred to before that excite that. No matter what Trump says, it's no good because he's a white nationalist. I mean, they just state it as a fact without really critically looking at it. And I don't think you need to even address the question. They're saying that forget if he doesn't want to have World War III, in essence. Forget if he's promising to redevelop cities, in essence. Those policies are intrinsically racist because they're presented by a racist. And implementing them would essentially advance the cause of white nationalism. In other words, for example, Trump is a white nationalist. He's also opposed to World War III. Therefore, opposing World War III will help to entrench white nationalism. That's the logic.
Exactly. It basically calls anything that Trump has said as as white supremacist. There's nothing that he can say or do that could change that fact. And I think what that does is repeat a very popular mistake at this point when it comes to analyzing white supremacy in the United States. It makes the fallacy that, you know, because an individual is racist and harbors racist intentions, that racist individual, anything that person does is in effect forwarding white supremacy. And also the voters and the people that voted for him are
They're racist.
One and the same. All racist.
Right.
And what that does is it totally negates, I mean, let's think about this. It totally negates the objective material conditions, a real analysis of the broader structural problems and structural social relations that really are driving this moment. Because we have to ask ourselves, would someone like Jamal Bowie, who wrote this article, would he write the same article about Hillary Clinton if she had won, about her cabinet, about her, about what she was all about? You know, would he be writing an article about how Democrats are ruining resistance to Hillary Clinton because they all got on board with her? Would he have done that? I highly doubt it. And I think this is a common fallacy. It's all interconnected, these common fallacies, painting everything with one stroke of white supremacy, while also, really just pushing the Democratic Party's resurrection, the Democratic Party agenda down people's throats.
Right.
I think
decapitating it. For example, doing it with Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren being demonized. You know, this is what gets me. I like a spinach mushroom and cheddar omelet, okay? So using the logic that's being applied, if, one of these so-called news stations covered Trump having breakfast somewhere and he ordered a spinach mushroom and cheddar omelet, from now on, when I go into a restaurant and order it, people are going to be side-eyeing me because I'm a racist, because that's a racist omelet. I mean, that's the level of discourse that we're talking about here.
Right. And what it does is it clouds any class analysis and any ability for a movement to fight for any real material relief and demands, which is part of the process of raising people's class consciousness, is getting them in motion to fight for things that they need.
And it negates their agency in that process too, but particularly that's the essential thing that happens here. No, they are not motivated by their abject poverty, by their intolerable conditions. Because Trump is a racist, what they're doing is advancing racism, period. That's their motivation.
Exactly. And I'm no Sandinista, and I've never held them up high. But I think that he did the correct thing here, regardless of what all of the critics will say. He did the exact correct thing by pointing out the domestic policy that Trump laid out and said, you better do this. And that is what I think should be promoted in the mass movement that has arisen out of the Trump victory. It shouldn't be just about, however disgusted we may be by Trump's rhetoric, because rhetoric alone won't ever bring change. We're not going to bring him into a room and say, or any of the, of his supporters that, do not share the same material, prospects and hopes out of a Trump presidency that other supporters may of his, you know, you're never going to bring them into a room and change them, like, you know, by having a discussion with them. The way you change things is by getting people in motion and demanding from the structures of power things that the system, you know, if we have a real analysis about it, just can't do right now. Right. So that, in effect, teaches millions of people what is the possibility under this system, and the fact that we need a new one. It gets as simple as that when we're talking about strategic movement.
Yeah. You've got to articulate a list of demands. I mean, if you're in the streets in opposition to Trump, okay, let's follow that out. Either you're just, you know, banging your head against the wall and not articulating your demands in the process, or you're aiding and abetting what's clearly an attempt at a soft coup, okay, which is being driven not by the people in the streets, it's only being aided by that, but rather by the elite that see Trump as a threat to their interests, or you're going to be successful in toppling the government, you know, creating a revolutionary condition, and you haven't even raised any demands yet. So who's going to pick up the pieces after that?
Exactly. And I think this whole fear-mongering about Trump, I honestly don't see it. You know, I think the people on the ground who have protested Trump, I think a lot of them and a lot of those who are not out on the streets but have very similar sentiments, I think that a lot of them are way more advanced politically in terms of their consciousness than what the Democratic Party fear-mongering machine will like us to believe. I think that there's this you know, there's this culture of fear that the Democratic Party has always used to build strength and to ultimately transform itself into the truest expression of the ruling class. It has always had that. Even in Obama's Hope and Change campaign, there was this element of fear. There's always this element of fear of the white man's party. And I feel like this fear of Trump that's being forced down the throats of the genuine masses of people that have decided to shift their alignment away from the two-party corporate duopoly is a raising of the stakes of this fear. It's the notion that the ruling class took a gamble on Trump, hoping that they could make, you know, so many people afraid of him that once, you know, whatever happens to his administration, because I'm still not convinced, regardless of the cabinet he chooses, that there's going to be some, you know, easy ride for him and he's going to follow GOP line. I don't think that's plausible at all for his administration. So the fact that we cannot see, or the left cannot see, the internal contradictions in Washington that are about to explode, literally explode after January 20th, if it gets that far.
Right.
You know, we're really missing a lot, and we're getting channeled back down this Democratic Party path, which you know, by all means and accounts, is the party of dead-end capitalism. It's the party of imperialism. And, you know, you said it before. If we decide to paint Trump's rhetoric about foreign policy, you know, about stopping regime change, about, you know, warming relations with Russia, you know, even China, if we paint all of that as one stroke of white supremacy, what we're effectively doing is reinforcing white supremacy, because a lot of the foreign policy, the imperial policy, that, you know, is rested upon that foundation of white supremacy, even against Russia. We saw it with, I mean, you played that great RT challenge, you know, the reporter who challenged the, you know, John Kirby. That was, you know, that was the language of white supremacy that John Kirby was speaking when he was segregating RT from the rest of the media, and basically saying that because it, you know, that RT is affiliated with Russia, that somehow it has no credibility. So, you know, that's honestly where we're at. And if we don't begin to realize this, if as, you know, as a left poll, we don't start to build a real movement against both parties of the corporate duopoly when the conditions are ripe for that, then we are, you know, we're in for a rough next 4 years.
and as you said, if we get there, I mean, we have ahead of us the Electoral College, which is supposed to meet and have the vote. The rules for doing that are, you know, extremely well established, and nevertheless, there have been these calls and a huge organizing effort, obviously very well organized and funded, where they grabbed 2 million signatures in 2 days, calling on the Electoral College to negate the election, basically, and to pick someone other than Trump. And then after that, so if he gets through that stage, and that's by no means certain, you then have the ratification of the Electoral College by a joint session of Congress on January 6th. And that's a Congress that, even though nominally the Republicans control both houses, a lot of those Republicans are speaking the same language as the people that are saying, you know, let's get rid of Trump at all costs. And then if he gets through that, you have 2 weeks from the 6th until the 20th that he has to not get shot or have a plane crash or a heart attack or whatever. And then the party begins. And, you know, to me, what's interesting is if you take a look at what actually could happen. I mean, the big fear is that Trump represents an unleashing of the forces of white supremacy and all that, as if they haven't been unleashed. I mean, I don't know what's AFRICOM. Okay. And you know, what is 28 hours in between police shootings of black people in the United States? And what is the, you know, a million and a half people of color that are in the prisons in the United States, and et cetera, et cetera. But this unleashing, and they reference back to Hitler all the time, is ahistorical as hell, and also has it lacks any concrete analysis of power or understanding of power politics. If Trump were actually, looking to advance a white supremacist agenda as such, unleashing it, the constituency for that, even if it's, if every person that voted for him is one of those deplorables, it's a minority, okay? It's about a quarter of the population. And so Hitler rode to power on a mass movement, a mass working class and middle class movement. And he didn't even reach power that way. He almost did. He lost the 1932 election to Paul von Hindenburg, who ran, by the way, with the slogan, "I'm with him." And had the left, except for the Communist Party, aligned with the elites to stop Hitler. He turns around. Hitler makes a deal with the bourgeoisie. That deal was, A, I'll do what you want as far as the economy goes. That second revolution that Rome and those people are talking about, where the party would expropriate you and set up a socialist economy, forget that. I'm going to take care of those guys after I get power. So he becomes chancellor. Then they have the little party at the Reichstag, you know, the Reichstag fire, which enables the enabling law, where suddenly Hitler is the Führer with unchecked power, handed over to him essentially by the bourgeoisie through its agent, Paul von Hindenburg, who was elected to stop him. Now,
still Democrats.
Okay. Then he attacks, he kills, you know, you have the Night of the Long Knives, and basically breaks up the organized working class, and forget the Second Revolution. Here we are. It's a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, fascist dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. Well, the political conditions for that do not exist in the United States.
No.
Okay. If Trump tried that, he's dead. The elite right now is allied against him. He has to either make a deal with them, which means he has to back away from the two things that got him elected. A, getting people jobs. No, instead we want more neoliberal economics, which means further impoverishment of working people and middle class, which means people finding their condition more and more intolerable, which means ultimately revolution. Or he has to find a new base. And the new base, the only new base available on, you know, if you look at the landscape, is the working class, which means he has to do outreach to try to build mass support as he goes to do policy with Congress, which is going to be opposed to him as agents of the elite.
Exactly. And there's, I think there's also a misconception about this moment. Trump doesn't really have the same options as prior administrations have had in trying to channel working class sentiment in a negative direction in the same way. I think that a lot of the things that he's actually said have been said before by prior Republican and Democratic Party administrations. You know, this attempt to divide the working class among immigration status. All of these things have been very tantamount to the two-party corporate duopoly over the last 30 years.
Yep.
So he doesn't really have the same options. These are things that have been exhausted. These are things that didn't really get him elected. A lot of people who say that Trump was elected because of these things are wholly mistaken, because if if white people as a whole and white nationalists, however we want to identify them, really just wanted a racist, a misogynist, they would have just settled for the Republican Party establishment.
Right. That's right.
Which, for a long time before Trump became the obvious winner in the primaries, it would have been probably more realistic for a lot of these same segments of the population to just go with the Republican Party establishment. I mean, that's just the objective facts. We can't look at Trump merely through this prism if we understand that these so-called forces that have been unleashed have been running rampant for centuries, but over the last 40 years, because of the neoliberal era, because of the crisis of capitalism, because of the endless wars and endless austerity, that racism as a whole has become a lot more structurally entrenched into the life, the life and social relations of the United States. It's I think for those who want to talk about this as some sort of Hitler moment, as some sort of, oh no, watch out, these, these brown shirts, these US-esque brown shirts are going to start, ravishing the population, Muslims, black people. It totally, obfuscates the material and structural dynamics of white supremacy, and basically says that the main issue, and I think it's a fear of revolution, that the main issue is individuals harboring of racism and their ability to organize that individual resentment into some sort of violent movement. I think that that also is a fear of revolution, in that it doesn't understand that even if that were to happen, we are basically saying that Muslims, black people, that these specific populations that are oppressed by white supremacy, regardless of who's in office, are unable to organize and defend themselves from that sort of force, which is basically all that they have ever done throughout the history of this country. So I think there's so many elements to it. A lot of it comes from the white liberal, the institutions that support white liberalism, a lot of the NGOs, nonprofits, the Democratic Party that controls all of it. This is where this analysis stems from, and we have to broaden it in order to take advantage of this moment. This moment, it doesn't mean that we don't pay attention to the white supremacist rhetoric of Donald Trump, but it means that we broaden out that rhetoric with the full picture of, look at what he has said. Look at what this is. These are things that we need. These are things that we don't care about Trump's intention. We don't care about what he's thinking in his mind. We care about these demands that the working class right now as a whole has stated are things that they want. And we have to listen to that in order to build trust and to build a real left movement that is rooted in the working class. This is what revolutionaries do. We're not here to pontificate, to argue with white supremacists and white nationalists. We're not here to, we expose that. We defend people, we defend the people from it. But we're not here to make that the primary focal point of our struggle. We're here to destroy the structural base from which it all arises from.
Yeah, and replace it with alternate structures that we're supposed to be building, and at least you have to start with demands. Danny Haifong is a regular columnist at blackagendareport.com. His column this coming week, Obama's departure is the reason to feel optimism for Trump's arrival. Danny, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.